Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted. Accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Monday night installment here at Your Remedy Is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various offensive litigating strategies. This is with our speaker, Mr. David Merlin. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy Is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy Is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedy Is in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com, if you look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes all of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedy Is in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of YourRemedyIsInTheLaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedy Is in the Law. And Your Remedy Is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at YourRemediesInTheLaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level, a based on a very strict, pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you'll get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points? What are you interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. If it affects your personal rights in one way or another, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of how you think of a network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. And maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do where I'm similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to a point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at State-Run Communications is just very simply get people start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using statewide communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator's screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. And we make those introductions. Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. The unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have had to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you call the remedy and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
All right, well, that is my ramble for this evening, folks. So without further ado, it is my pleasure to turn the call over at this time to our speaker for this evening, Mr. David Merland.
Hi, Martin. Hi, everybody. My name is David Merland. Nothing you'll hear me say is intended as legal advice. Anything that sounds like that to you, just consider it something somebody else might do on a planet far, far away where the law matters. It doesn't matter here. I prove it on a daily basis. Believe it. Great day for women everywhere here in America because Darren Sharper, D-A-R-R-E-N, Darren Sharper, was sentenced to 20 years in prison after a global plea deal, which means resolving all of the charges against him at once, despite the fact that they arose in several states, with the obligation to serve the longest of all of the concurring sentences. They will run concurrently. They'll run at the same time. And so he's strapped to the terms of the longest of all of the sentences for the rape of women in many states. And this is a former NFL star who, when busted, was in possession, somewhere along the lines, I think I heard he was in possession of more than 30 sleeping pills. So he was the date rapist. He would drug women and have his way with them while they were unconscious. And he got busted, charges in several states, and he has pled guilty and is off of the most wanted list. He's now in prison. So I think since 2012, he's been in prison on these charges, and he'll get credit for time served. So it's great to see justice being done for the victims of that former NFL star. And as a former NFL star, you don't think the guy had enough money to where he could not attract the woman of his choice, but to at least attract people who wouldn't necessarily be counted as victims. He could have had what he wanted, but he chose to take what wasn't his, and he's going down. So, anyway, great day. The last call. I don't know how many new people we have on this call. In the call last week, last Monday, all these calls every week for going almost a year now, you can access calls that I have done here with Your Remedy is in the Law. every Monday night, with just a couple of exceptions. And you can find those in the archive here at Your Remedy Is in the Law. You want to subscribe to the archive. I'm just one of several speakers that is taped on calls every week. And for a nominal fee, you get access to the entire archive of all of the calls of all the information providers. Tom Smith in Utah, who knows how to prevent the electronic records kept by the IRS from being entered into evidence. I'm not real familiar with his work, but there's so many angles of attack you could choose from, and when you find one that actually renders remedy, you want to keep hitting that button until it falls off the control panel. And I found one such button, and we hear its context articulated in very plain language in something I covered last week, from Model Circuit, Ninth Circuit Model Criminal Jury Instructions. Ninth Circuit Model Criminal Jury Instructions about willful failure to file or willful tax evasion. And I'm looking particularly at Ninth Circuit Model Criminal Jury Instruction 9.42. A defendant who acts on a good faith misunderstanding as to the requirements of the law does not act willfully, even if his understanding of the law is wrong and unreasonable. Nevertheless, merely disagreeing with the law does not constitute a good faith misunderstanding of the law, because all persons have a duty to obey the law whether or not they agree with it. Thus, in order to prove that the defendant acted willfully, the government must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant did not have a good faith belief that he was complying with the law. That's a real simple instruction. Thus, in order to prove that the defendant acted willfully, the government must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant did not have a good faith belief that he was complying with the law. Did it say that the defendant has a burden of proof to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he had a good faith belief in the law? It said that the government must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant did not have a good faith belief that he was complying with the law. Hey, I've read the language of Tax Code Section 83, Servant Breath, and after reading that statute, I get the understanding that only the excess over the amount paid is gross income when I receive compensation for services. And the amount paid is defined as the value of any property I paid for that paycheck. Labor is property. Its value is what I get under contract. And only the excess over the amount paid is gross income. I didn't receive any excess over the value of my labor. You deprived me of Section 83 by including my paycheck in gross income so you could tax it. What were you thinking? The government can't mount a challenge to that frontal assault on its taxation of the value of labor. Wouldn't you want to have that understanding of the law? You say I'm a citizen of the United States, Servant Breath. Well, when I look at the tax code, I know I'm not Chapter 23, Chapter 21, or Chapter 2. Those are all Social Security. That leaves just Chapter 1. And there is no statute in Chapter 1 naming U.S. citizens as liable for an income tax. Only in regulation, under Section 1 of the code where we find the tax brackets, are U.S. citizens referred to even vaguely as owing an income tax. It's in regulation. The 16th Amendment says Congress can lay and collect income taxes. It has to be a statute. Do you have anything more than a regulation, like a statute, that says U.S. citizens owe the tax? If you don't, what are you doing talking to me about the Internal Revenue Code? What were you thinking? The government can't mount or muster a challenge to that allegation, to that affirmative attack on in personam jurisdiction. And you heard that it was based on statutory construction. It's not based on limited federal authority. It's not based on lack of federal citizenship. It's not based on all of the other arguments out there. You can only get these arguments, teachings about them, from my materials or from people who plagiarized my work. And these two core findings, they're the two that do the heaviest lifting. The first one was, I don't owe a tax on my labor, and the second one is actually first, it's biggest, and it says the Internal Revenue Code's never been written to apply to citizens of the United States. So if you say that's my citizenship, show me the statute. We know it's not in Chapters 2, 21, and 23. Chapter 2, Social Security Self-Employed. Chapter 21, FICA, Employee Social Security. And Chapter 23, Federal Unemployment Tax Act, an excise tax on your employer that comes right out of your paycheck. Wasn't that easy? I know I'm not Chapters 2, 21, and 23, because those don't apply to my citizenship. I'm a citizen of the United States. I'm just in Chapter 1, and I wouldn't be had you not written that regulation under Section 1 of the Code, 26 CFR 1.1-1. Checkmate. I'm here every week discussing these findings. If somebody knew that on a certain day, at a certain time, a flying saucer was going to land on the roof of the White House, do you think you'd find them talking about anything else ever? And so I'm here every week talking about these very things. The illegal revenue streams, the biggest ones the government makes. A month ago, the government announced, hey, everybody, in the fiscal quarter of November, December, January, the federal government collected more in income taxes than in any other quarter in history. A trillion dollars. What was I thinking? And they stole every penny of it. And now you got Ted Cruz and Rand Paul they're going to be running for president. Ted Cruz announced it today. I'm running for president. And he wants a flat tax. I think Rand Paul wants a fair tax. I don't see a difference between the two, because all it will serve to do is legitimize what the federal government has always stolen from people in the 50 states. Why would you want to legitimize it? And these are two people that couldn't even tell you what is in the tax code. They have no clue. The IRS has no clue until they read my work, and then they found out what they've always been doing to people. And do you want a federal government that would steal from us for decades, decades and decades, simply legitimizing the revenue stream we've never owed it, so that they could maintain their campaign of terror around the planet? Afghanistan is pleading with the president, which hurts to say because he's trash, pleading with the president to leave more troops in Afghanistan. And now Iran is fighting Iraq's battles for Iraq because we didn't go back in there to straighten out the problems they have right now. Multiple bombs went off in Iraq today. Tourists were attacked a week ago or so in Tunisia, getting off a bus to go to the museum. And the four gunmen stormed the museum and told all the employees, who are obviously Tunisians, to get down, keep your head down, or you'll get shot. And they went in and took a bunch of hostages and killed them all. And now in Libya, you have, I think it was ISIS, on the rampage in Libya. So that's Libya, Syria, Iraq, Tunisia, Yemen, 120 U.S. personnel just pulled out of Tunisia because it's falling apart. And a few months ago, the president says, look at our our successes. Yemen. Well, Yemen is a wasteland. And how much of this do you think would have happened if the government hadn't stolen from us every year what it steals from us? And so I don't have much more to talk about than illegal revenue streams. 1, 2, and 3. Actually, 4 if you want to slice it more precisely. Social Security has always been theft. Chapter 1 has always been theft because they named us in regulation only. That's capital gains and tax on compensation for services. And let's see. Then there's state income tax based on the Fed. And then there's the motor vehicle code. All of it is theft. Listen to what I found in Colorado. And it was almost, now I'm a professional, and so it's not really startling. It's new every time you see it because you just can't believe what they've done to us. You don't get used to being fleeced. However, this was startlingly easy to prove. If I don't owe federal income tax and the state tax code says what you owe the state in state income taxes is a percentage of what you owe the federal government, and I don't owe the federal government anything, I know that a percentage of zero is still zero, isn't it? And so all these states that impose an income tax, almost all of them that I've looked at anyway, they say, hey, your state income tax is a percentage of what you pay the Fed. We have Section 83 of the tax code. In California Code Section 17081 expressly adopts by reference Section 83 of the tax code. So I know Section 83 applies in California under state law. It doesn't get much easier than this. Well, it got easier than that in Colorado today. Somebody called me from Colorado. I said, I'll look up your state law and see if I can make an argument. Listen to this. I'm looking at Colorado Code Section 39-22-104. That's Colorado Code Section 39-22-104. Subsection 1. Let's see. And it says, after January 1st of 1987, but prior to 1999, a tax of 5% is imposed on the federal taxable income, as determined pursuant to Section 63 of the Internal Revenue Code of every individual, estate, and trust. 1.5. After January 1st of 1999, but prior to January 1 of 2000, a tax of 4.75% is imposed on the federal taxable income, as determined pursuant to Section 63 of the Internal Revenue Code of every individual, estate, and trust. Paragraph 1.7, so you can see their amendments. The first one is after 1987, but before New Year's 99. The second one is after New Year's 99, but before New Year's 2000, so it's just for the year of 1999. Then we have the next one, which is for years after January 1st of 2000. So since 2000, this has been the tax. It says a tax of 4.63% is imposed on federal taxable income as determined pursuant to Section 63 of the Internal Revenue Code of every individual, estate, and trust. Wasn't that easy? There. It was the first statute I looked at, and it said in terms that are a lot easier to understand and correlate to Section 83 of the tax code, about the easiest statute I've seen in state law providing an argument for Section 83 on the state level. First statute I looked at, bingo. Right out there in plain sight. In Colorado, you owe 4.63% on the federal taxable income. And if the federal tax code doesn't say that the compensation for services you made is taxable income, then there's an equation you have to follow. It's called Codebreaker, the Section 83 equation, which is a manual you can get from Martin and Michael here at Your Remedy that says start in 83, and if you only if you identify an excess over the amount paid, do you have an amount to go to gross income. And so you identify the excess, and you include only the excess in gross income, 61A. Then you take all the allowable deductions, and you end up in Section 63A as your taxable income. 63A, taxable income defined. Taxable income shall be gross income minus the deductions allowable by this subchapter, or by this subtitle. We just did that. Deductions, like 151D and 63C, the standard exemption or personal deduction. You get a deduction for the interest you pay on your mortgage to your house. I think it's Section 163. Certain state taxes, Section 164. But we can't even go there until you've identified an excess over the amount paid. Section 83 has to operate before you're allowed to say the word gross income. So the first statute I looked at in Colorado, bingo. Piece of cake to prove that under state law, Colorado, they're depriving everybody of the provisions of 39-22-104 to tax the value of their labor. So you don't hear me talking about much else. Social Security is theft. Chapter 1, I'm named in a regulation only, so that's theft. And state income tax law, I live in Washington. They don't have an income tax here, but they're trying to make one. And then you have the motor vehicle code. I have the right of public vehicular travel. It's a right. It says so in the law from coast to coast. And let me chat it up about that one right now while it's on my mind. I'm going to do a Google search for open as a matter of right to public vehicular travel. And I get 3.15 million hits. It's in the law from coast to coast. So why would I submit to a privilege of operating a motor vehicle when I know that my conduct, going to the store, taking my child to the soccer game, driving to work in the morning, driving back home at night, I know that's not a privilege. That's a right. So why submit to the motor vehicle code? So all you hear me talking about is illegal revenue streams because one of the keys to tame relations with our public servants is to shrink the size of government. When government just doesn't have time or resources to go out and prosecute you because you let your 10-year-old boy and your 6-year-old daughter walk together 1 mile from school to your home in the afternoon. That just happened several weeks ago. I can't remember what state. But the cops saw this boy and this girl walking down the sidewalk, and where are you headed? And they said, we're walking home from school. A whole mile, everybody. And he put the kids in the cop car and drove them home, and the parents now are on a probationary period with Child Protective Services because they let their child walk a mile. More than a year ago, I think it was, there was a woman who, while at work at McDonald's, let her 9-year-old daughter play in the park during her shift. Somebody saw that the daughter was out there unattended, and she was prosecuted for child neglect. If government didn't have time for that type of crap, and if government didn't have time to campaign against your rights to protect yourself by bearing arms, and you instead owned firearms to protect yourself, I don't think we would have the problem with gangs that we now have. Arkansas has a problem with gangs, I heard today on the news. How many problems would there be with gang members if everybody was packing? There are some people that when they own a gun, they don't use it properly, and they use it for criminal acts. There are others, though, who wouldn't use their gun until it was time to defend themselves against criminal acts. And if the government wasn't in the role of who call, don't take the law into your own hands, take them to people's court, horse crap. Take care of it yourself. You look at your self-defense laws in your state, you're going to have the right to arrest a felon. You're going to have the right maybe to justifiable homicide to prevent a crime against you and your family. I said a crime. What's a crime? Fourth degree assault. If somebody simply came up to you and pushed their finger into your chest saying, I was in line, or I'm cutting in line, there's nothing you can do about it, pal, and they point in your chest and jab their finger in your chest, that's fourth degree assault. That's an offense. New Mexico, 30-2-7, homicide, when justifiable, to prevent an offense against you, your wife, or your family. An offense. That's a crime of any degree, of any nature. How many problems would we have? We're relying on government to enforce all, and you know that government doesn't enforce the law against public servants, and you know that they leave the little stuff alone because they got too much big stuff to deal with. They're in the wrong place. They should get the hell out of the way and give people a bunch more of their power back and stop lying to us on the TV and the radio. And everybody should own firearms. And you'd watch the crime rate plummet. Washington, D.C., strictest gun laws in the nation. At least until that Heller decision of a few years ago. And who had the highest murder rate? Washington, D.C. See how that works? And there's tons of statistics. There's a great book out. I haven't read it, but I've listened to the talk show host that wrote the book for months now, and she knows what the hell she's talking about. The book is called Hands Off My Gun, Defeating the War to Disarm America, or Winning the War to Disarm America. Take Your Hands Off My Gun by Dana Loesch, L-O-E-S-C-H, and she'll have all the statistics in there and all the arguments against people who say the Second Amendment has to go. So there's a very current book written by somebody that goes to the firing range and loves shooting the big rifles and the big pistols, and she's fun to listen to. Really got her feet on the ground. So government has gotten entirely too big, and that was decades ago. That was true, and it's only gotten worse. And one surefire way to keep government from growing any further or to actually shrink government is to shrink its budget by exposing that a lot of the revenue they get from us is extortion and racketeering. That's all it is. Whether it's admiralty jurisdiction or whether you use the zip code, any of the other Patriot Movement garbage theories out there, they're all a bunch of morons. And I can't help them. You show them an offense. Hey, the IRS deprived you of Section 83 to tax your paycheck. They go, well, I don't care. I revoked my signature, and I filed an offer in demand, and I'll call you when I get out of prison. There. That's the Patriot Movement. Got a call the other day from a guy that says, yeah, I just wanted to share with you that there's a victory. I got a victory. What's that? He said, well, I paid it off, $56,000 that the IRS said I owe him, and I'm getting a refund for $740 paid too much. Really? How'd you do that? Oh, well, I served him with a personal security drawn on a closed checking account. because the checking account is never closed, you know, and you've got this credit with the U.S. government. And I said, I hope you're not doing an end zone dance because you just started a statute of limitations clicking. Well, why would they send me $740? I said, because they're not a victim until they do. And it's harder to convict somebody that they didn't refund money to. But now that they've refunded some money to you, they're a victim of yours. And until the statute of limitations runs on that, probably 5 years, I'd be looking over my shoulder if I were you. That's what I had to tell the guy. You don't have a victory until the statute of limitations is up. And somewhere in there, you might be indicted for filing false and fraudulent statements or securities or false claims with the government. Totally outside the tax code, so I can't help you. And he knows my findings. We've spoken more than a dozen times on the phone, a couple times at length. He knows of my materials. He has all of them. Yeah, I filed a security on a closed checking account. Well, nice to know you. There's some people you just can't reach. And I'm not going to sit here and try to convince you. You're lucky you met me. That's your job. You're an adult. You're an American. Do the work. Get the materials and see if I'm wrong. And if I'm wrong, if you can prove me wrong, you've got to go to the government right away. They'll hire you. You're the best attorney in the world because their attorneys can't even talk to me about these two arguments. Social Security is theft, and I'm only named in a regulation in Chapter 1. And secondly, you deprived me of Section 83 when you taxed my compensation. What were you thinking? And it's all meticulously briefed, presented to three committees and Ron Paul, three congressional committees, every member, nearly 80 people in Congress, January 1st of 06, supplemental brief, August 27th, 2014, second supplemental briefing, February 25th, 2015. And when you take on these arguments, I think the government views you as one who has a good faith understanding of the law. And we know from this jury instruction, the government bears the burden of proving, quote, Ninth Circuit Model Criminal Jury Instruction 9.42, quote, thus, in order to prove that the defendant acted willfully, the government must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant did not have a good faith belief that he was complying with the law. Well, I believe I'm complying with the law when I don't include the value of my labor in gross income, Section 83. And I don't have a choice. They don't have a choice. Nobody has a choice. You have to comply with Section 83 because tax court, the appellate courts, and the IRS chief counsel say that Section 83 explains how to tax compensation, it governs the taxation of compensation, and it provides for the determination of what is to be included in gross income when somebody receives compensation. And so if all you did was receive compensation, you start and end with that argument. How do I comply with Section 83? They can't talk. It's an unenforced statute. When I spotted it in 1992, I said, if this applies to me, it isn't being enforced. And I was studying other people's work up to that time, from 1988 summer to the summer of 1992. I was studying other people, and I was led in a bunch of different directions that you go when you're studying other people who didn't read the tax code beginning at page one. And so I shut everybody else out when I saw these frivolous filing penalties, went back to page one, started reading the tax code, came to Section 83, because that's what happens when you start reading at page one. And when I came to Section 83, I said, if this applies to me, it's not being enforced. And I went straight to the law library, and I read 70 or 80 cases about Section 83 and found a bunch that say, Section 83 explains how to tax all compensation for services. It applies to all of it. It governs the taxation of compensation. And I found in Section 83's language all of the tools I needed to make the argument that all property is a cost, even labor. You can't deduct labor, it's gone, and so you have to deduct its value. And so when I do that, when I identify the amount paid, I can identify the excess. That's the definition of income. It's right there in the tax code. Income is the excess over the amount paid. It's the profit over your cost. Cost defines profit. Cost is the definition of income. Income is what's left over when you've identified your cost. You identify cost, you have identified excess in one equation. I figured out my cost. That means you know what your income was. It was your excess. How much over the value of your labor did you receive? Nothing. That's your income. And so I found all the tools I needed to make that argument right there in Section 83. And what does the government do when faced with this? Well, they've closed IRS Criminal Investigations Division investigations, and they've closed grand jury proceedings. Why? Because they have the burden to prove that the defendant acted willfully. Beyond a reasonable doubt, that defendant did not have a good faith belief that he was complying with the law. Isn't that simple? Took a lot to get there. I had to forget 90% of what I learned and concentrate on the 10% that's actually got arguments in it, maybe 5% of everything I learned in the tax code. There's only some of it that leads to an argument, and this one's dynamite. So I filed this complaint with Congress, and to make that your complaint, so that you can say, I've complained to Congress. You're a criminal, servant breath, and I've complained to Congress to have you arrested because you deprived me of Section 83. What's even worse is you shouldn't even talk to me about the Internal Revenue Code. I'm only mentioned in regulation. What were you thinking? Checkmate. So, against the likelihood of an indictment is the arena that this functions, in which this functions best, is to show that you have an understanding of the law. It's not a misunderstanding. They can't even prove you're wrong. But it makes it much harder to get a conviction when the burden of proof is on them to prove you didn't have a good faith misunderstanding of the law. So, contact Martin and Michael. Join the complaint. It's a process. You'll fill out an affidavit, have it notarized, send it to my office. We send it to Congress, and you get a return in the mail of a blue signature certificate of service to prove that you've brought this crime to the attention of three committees and Ron Paul is no longer in Congress, so just three committees, nearly, I think it's like 70 members of Congress, 80, somewhere in there. And you then can wield photocopies of this complaint to anybody that says that you owe money under the Federal Internal Revenue Code for capital gains or compensation for services. So a whole bunch of meticulous and exhaustive research, competently done with a strict adherence to the maxims of statutory construction and canons of interpretation, has all been boiled down to a couple of key arguments that block the government when they seek to prove that you did not have a good faith belief that you were in compliance with the law. If all you had to say in front of the jury was, oh, I got a closed checking account. That's what I got. And I furnished a personal security to the government to pay off that debt of $56,000. How's that a good faith belief in the law? You contrived and conjured up some cockamamie theory about having an account with the government that no one's ever seen proof of. And you just issued a personal security and got a little refund to defraud the government out of that money. How many of you, members of the jury, how many of you pay income taxes? They're all going to say, I do. Well, this guy thinks he doesn't have to pay any because he's got a checking account that was closed. You're going to jail. And instead, from the get-go, you deprived me of Section 83 to tax my pay. I'm only named in the regulation. What were you thinking? That's the hurdle the government has to cross, has to surmount when they set about this in Jury Instruction 9.42 for the Ninth Circuit. Thus, in order to prove that the defendant acted willfully, the government must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant did not have a good faith belief that he was complying with the law. Now, in that memorandum that went to Congress, I'm going to tell you something really funny, and then we'll get to a couple of questions. This is downright cute. Let's see here. Complaint to Congress. Memorandum. I have the first 16 pages of this 58-page memorandum is a briefing of how you have to interpret statute. Based on a bunch of Supreme Court decisions that say when we encounter a statute, we have to do A, B, C, and jump through this hoop, that hoop, and this hoop. They tell you just how to interpret statute. And then I get to page like 16 through 45 is a briefing of several claims. And under issue A, I'm only named in a regulation. I have a summary of only two paragraphs saying if your eyes roll back in your head when you read this brief, let me just summarize here in a paragraph what the hell I'm trying to tell you. So there's a summary. And then questions presented for review under issue A. We're right before the questions. Paragraph 4.11 of my memorandum. And I'm the petitioner. I'm petitioning Congress to report these crimes. The mention of petitioner's citizenship in a mere regulation is a grossly insufficient basis upon which to tax the petitioner. The Secretary of the Treasury has imposed a tax on the petitioner through 26 CFR 1.1-1, but has done so without authority to do so, the authority to lay income tax having been reserved to Congress and Congress alone. Said regulation is null and void and for derogation of statute. Listen to this. This is extremely important. This is petitioner's belief, and until it is dispelled with open discussion and logical application to the contrary, petitioner will continue to act upon it. This is a sworn statement. And so if I act in a contrary manner, I'm committing perjury. I said in this statement, I'll continue to act upon this conclusion under penalties of perjury. And so if I don't continue to act on this conclusion, meaning if I don't behave as if they've imposed a tax through regulation alone, I've committed perjury. Yes, I have a pair. And I dropped them on the desk of almost 80 congressmen. And so I'm not out here saying, okay, everybody, I think what you ought to do is just be a wimp and go off on some controversial mythology path with the Patriot Movement. I'm hitting the government with plain issues at law, briefed the way attorneys are expected to brief their findings, argued eloquently, straight, no rhetoric, and I tell them, right here, here's the end. This is paragraph 4.48 about Section 83 in my conclusion of that briefing. That's 10 pages long. To report as gross income, let's see. To report as gross income, the value of personal services, the petitioner must enter a false statement on a government form in violation of 18 U.S.C. 1001. I'm telling Congress this. And I've never gotten a single reply back from the government over any of this. So, the next issue, about 6201A, which limits assessment authority to taxes paid by stamp. That's not ATF. It's foreign insurers and casinos in the 4300s and 4400s of the tax code. Paragraph 4.54, this is petitioner's belief, and until it is dispelled with open discussion and logical application of law to the contrary, petitioner will continue to act upon it. No one has read it to the government this way, ever, except me. So, enough said, really. If you want to wield this complaint as if it's your own, I would start by first acquiring the flash drive, 7 video segments, a total of 3 hours, 45 minutes of instruction with me at a whiteboard in 2003 in a string of seminars I taught here in Seattle to a small group that is no group of, no group at all now. We just had another meeting Wednesday of last week, was it? Or a week before, and just 2 people showed up, so it's not even a group anymore. Washington is not at all fertile with regards to addressing the wrongs that government does. They've gone to sleep. But anyway, in 2003, I taught some seminars here, and these are video segments from those seminars that I specifically taught for the purposes of taping different aspects of the Internal Revenue Code. And each one of the heaviest lifting arguments are are explained on a whiteboard. And I diagrammed the internal structure of the tax code to outline these particular arguments. And then the last segment is called Tax Code from the Ground Up. I outline the way the law should work according to statute only. And I show you all the limitations on government authority, and then I build on that with regulations that twisted the law, elements of misenforcement that ignore the law, to prove they're stealing pennies and to prove they're stealing everything and the tricks they pulled on the tax code to accomplish it. Tax code from the ground up, one particular comment I got from somebody, I got the videos, you have the sharpest mind I've ever witnessed. So if somebody isn't diagramming the tax code when they seek to explain it to you, they don't know what they're talking about. And these are the people that refuse to debate me. And the Patriot Movement stands out there and throws stones at me. I got an idea. All you can throw is stones instead of rebuttals, which means you haven't even read my work. Can you disprove any of my findings? No. Well, then what are you doing throwing stones at me for? You interested in the truth? No, we're interested in our own conclusions that are based on our ignorance of the law, so we can sell a curriculum to James Back, and so James Back can be sentenced to 16 months in prison last December 16th for filing Pete Hendrickson tax returns. So I am not in the movement. I am not a sovereign citizen. I don't have anything to do with those people, and they aren't fighting for freedom. They're fighting for internet fraud by asking you to pay them for their findings and their books, which are based on an analysis of the tax code, if you're lucky, that is so tragically deficient, they're essentially in paralegal romper room. Question and answer, Martin.
All righty. *2 on your keypad, folks, if you have a question. That's for everybody that's on the call with us. If you dialed in a number, you put in a PIN. *2 at this time to raise your hand. For everybody else listening throughout the country at freedomsradio.com, type your questions in the question bar at this time and click submit.
And for an attitude just like mine, you can have one installed at the police precinct nearest you.
Yeah, and if you're interested in picking up, of course, any of Mr. Merlin's courses here, whether it's the Section 83 book you're after or the Fundamental Flash Drive, if you'd like to join the complaint, maybe it's one of his processes you're interested in, get a hold of us at Your Remedies in the Law,
yourremedyisinthelaw.com. You can email me directly as well. I am Martin Michaels, and that email address is mm@yourremedyisinthelaw.com.
So the IRS agent that approaches you has to comply with Section 83 also. So does the president. It applies to all compensation. So you can ask the IRS agent that says you owe money, how did Section 83 operate last year when you filed your tax returns? They can't talk. It's a forgotten paragraph of law, Section 83A. Go to the web. Look it up. It's right there. Right there in the law. And everybody says it applies. Okay, well, if that's it, I've got places to go and people to do.
All right. Okay, I thought I saw a question pop up. Yeah, there we go. Linda, you had a question?
Yes, Michael, good evening. Say,
hi, Linda.
Yes. Hi, David.
Hi, Linda. Hi. Good to hear from you.
Thank you. I got a greeting from the IRS that says I owe $36,000, and I wanted to ask you, is my first step to reply to them and ask them for their accounting with a wedding blue signed name under it?
There's a lot of reasons to ask for that. None of them are really relevant because not only does the agent have to know what they're doing, the Secretary of the Treasury that supervises the IRS has to know what he's doing. And so I don't even approach the question as to why the document wasn't signed under penalties of perjury, why the document wasn't signed by a human being. I simply take the name that they gave the document and the name that they call themselves and say, this person sent me through the mail a demand for money that I don't owe, they know I don't owe it, and I hereby report them as criminal to Congress. That's if you want to file an affidavit of joinder with Congress. Other than that, contact Martin and Michael, and they'll hook you up with somebody. I don't do liens and levies. I concentrate on the criminal side, and I'm very good at it, and I have had success in closing down grand jury proceedings. However, in the case of their pursuit of your money, I don't operate in that venue. There are other people, though, that do work to try to keep the IRS from getting your money, and I would suggest them as opposed to you can still get my materials, and you'll learn just what they're doing to you all the time. But as far as that particular problem, you want somebody that knows how to address liens and levies, and Martin and Michael can probably set you up with somebody.
Okay, so in other words, when you're talking criminal, you're talking about after they start collecting?
No, I'm talking about if they're saying, well, you haven't paid, you haven't filed your tax returns, we're going to forward this to the Criminal Investigations Division of the IRS, and they're going to investigate you. And that's when they issue summons and subpoenas and get all your records so they can later indict you. That's what I try to prevent.
I see. So I can probably nip this in the bud at this stage, correct?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, Martin, I'll be in touch with you and see who on your team I should talk to.
All right,
Thank you so much, Linda. Nice speaking with you. What state are you in, Linda?
Mexico.
New Mexico?
Yeah.
Okay. Hang on just a second. I want to see if New Mexico is one of the states that I've on a state level, if you ever hear from your state taxing authorities, you ready to write?
Ready.
New Mexico State Statute 7-1-4.
All right.
0.1, 0.2, 0.3, and 7-2-2, and 7-2-3, and 7-2-9. Those are the state laws I would focus on if I were to make an argument under New Mexico statutes against your state taxing authorities. Also, 7-2-2, definitions. For the purposes of income tax, this Income Tax Act, adjusted gross income means adjusted gross income is defined in Section 62 of the Internal Revenue Code. That was 7-2-2. So to tax me under the State Tax Act for income tax in New Mexico, you have to deprive me of the provisions of 7-2-2.
Okay. And I could just Google that, right?
Yeah, I would go to Google and put in New Mexico Revised Statutes 7-2-2, and it'll come right up with it.
Thank you.
Of course, and if you want an argument made out of that, you talk to Martin and Michael, and they'll schedule a consultation with me, okay?
All right. Fine. Thank you, David.
Okay. Thanks for joining the call tonight.
All right. All right. That takes care of us for this evening, Mr. Merlin. Thank you so much, and we'll look forward to seeing you again next week.
Okay, everybody. Can do. It's been my pleasure. Good night.
All right, folks, again, if you are interested in picking up any of Mr. Merlin's material, get a hold of us at Your Remedy is in the Law, www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com. Again, you can email me directly if that's easier for you. And that email address is mm@yourremedyisinthelaw.com. Join us again tomorrow night, same time, same place. We'll be having our normal Tuesday night call with Mr. Tony Davis discussing various IRS administrative remedies and possibly some updates on some other things as well. So until next time, have a pleasant evening and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.